wrong and gets in the way of his work and his sleep and his meals. It's like being in love. And while the author is in this state, the man will, of course, have to criticize the proposed book from quite a different point of view. He will ask how the gratification of this impulse will fit in with all the other things he wants and ought to do or be. Perhaps the whole thing is too frivolous and trivial, from the man's point of view, not the author's, to justify the time and pains it would involve. Perhaps it would be unedifying when it was done. Or else perhaps, at this point the author cheers up, it looks like being good, not in a merely literary sense, but good all round. This may sound rather complicated, but it is really very like what happens about other things. You are attracted by a girl. But is she the sort of girl you'd be wise or right to marry? You would like to have lobster for lunch, but does it agree with you, and is it wicked to spend that amount of money on a meal? The author's impulse is a desire. It is very like an itch, and of course, like every other desire, needs to be criticized by the whole man. Let me now apply this to my own fairy tales. Some people think that I began by asking myself how I could say something about Christianity to children, then fixed on the fairy tale as an instrument, then collected information about child psychology and decided what age group I'd write for, then drew up a list of basic Christian truths and hammered out allegories to embody them. This is all pure moonshine. I couldn't write in that way at all. Everything began with images, a fawn carrying an umbrella, a queen on a sledge, a magnificent lion. At first, there wasn't even anything Christian about them. That element pushed itself in of its own accord. It was part of the bubbling. Then came the form. As these images sorted themselves into events, i.e. became a story, they seemed to demand no love interest and no close psychology. But the form which excludes these things is the fairy tale. And the moment I thought of that, I fell in love with the form itself, its brevity, its severe restraints on description, its flexible traditionalism, its inflexible hostility to all analysis, digression, reflections, and gas. I was now enamoured of it. Its very limitations of vocabulary became an attraction. As the hardness of the stone pleases the sculptor, or the difficulty of the sonnet delights the sonneteer. On that side, as author, I wrote fairy tales because the fairy tale seemed the ideal form for the stuff I had to say. Then, of course, the man in me began to have his turn. I thought I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God, or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings. And reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices, almost as if it were something medical. But supposing that, by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them, for the first time, appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. That was the man's motive. But, of course, he could have done nothing if the author had not been on the boil first. You will notice that I have throughout spoken of fairy tales, not children's stories. Professor J.R.R. Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings has shown that the connection between fairy tales and children...